learned the lessons of the past. For centuries, his organization had used couriers who would exchange information person to person. That way, there was control of anything sensitive. But then they started operating in America, and they got lazy. In the late 50s, they started to use the telephone, and it was their downfall. If information is important, and you want to keep it safe, you must communicate in person. That way, you keep control. I started to see signs for the E-75 and Mikkeli. Then the tree line disappeared, and the motorway came into view about 400 meters below me on the right. Lines of headlights moved in both directions, but we stayed on the old road, and the trees returned to cut out the view. It would be easier to see if anyone was behind us. Liv continued. As to the rest of your question, we take all necessary precautions. Not only with our information, but with our people. That's the reason why all contact from now on will be exclusively with me. I decided not to tell her what had happened after leaving the flat. She and Val knew far too much about me already. Streetlights sprang up at the roadside, and signs told me we were approaching a place called Hinola. Tom sparked up, taking out his earpieces. A low-toned, tinny dance beat filled the air. Are we there yet? Liv helped out. Another 30 minutes, Tom. He became a bashful schoolboy again. Oh, thanks. Liv turned the heating down a notch and pulled off her hat. Her hair bounced around her shoulders. Tom was looking out at the town and daydreaming as he pulled a tissue from his pocket and blew his nose, then examined his effort in the streetlight, as if it held some sort of prophecy. We finished moving around the town, another anti-surveillance maneuver, and left on a much smaller road. The houses and lights quickly dwindled, and trees and darkness soon took over, with just the occasional track leading into the woods. Liv was still checking behind us for lights, and Tom, having found the meaning of life in his Kleenex, went back to listening to his music. Eventually we turned onto a tarmac road, tree-lined and cleared of snow, then carried on for another 2 to 3 km down a slight hill until the trees gave way to a house that was suddenly illuminated by ground lights as the vehicle approached. We must have passed a sensor. The place looked like something out of a James Bond film. Blofeld was probably looking down on us from inside, stroking his cat. It was maybe 60 or 70 meters long and looked just as if someone had taken an enormous slice out of an apartment block and perched it 20 feet off the ground on 2 massive concrete supports. Val certainly did things in style. The driveway took us under the house, where glass panels sealed the area around the pillars to make an internal car park. 2 large patio-type doors opened automatically as we approached, then closed behind us. It was surprisingly warm as I stepped out of the murk. The lights shining through the windows and the reflection of the snow made me screw up my face until my eyes adjusted. Liv hit a key fob and a brown door opened in the left-hand pillar. Tom and I grabbed our bags and followed her into a hot stairwell. I noticed that Light's brown walking boots had replaced the cowboy look. We entered a vast, high-ceilinged space, maybe 30 meters long and 20 wide. And, just like the London flat, it was clinically white and sparsely furnished. There was a door to my immediate right which led into the kitchen, through which I could see white veneer cupboards and steel worktops. The living area, where we were standing, was straight out of a Sunday supplement. 2 white leather settees faced each other across a glass and chrome coffee table. And that was it. No TV, music center, magazines, flowers, pictures on the wall, nothing. White vertical blinds stretched from floor to ceiling where I expected windows to be. The lighting was low, and supplied by wall lamps, white, of course. There were no fittings on the ceiling. Tom and I stood with our bags in our hands, taking it all in. I'll show you your rooms. Liv was already walking towards the far right-hand door. I wondered if she ever waited for anyone, or if Armani insisted she always went in front. We followed into a corridor, our shoes squeaking on the polished wooden floor. My room was through the first door on the left. Again, it was a world of white, with a low, Japanese-style bed, ensuite shower, white marble tiling, and stacks of brand-new white towels. There was no wardrobe, just small canvas storage spaces suspended from a chrome rail. Surprisingly, because the view must have been fantastic, there were no windows. Liv said, "No need. It's always too dark." I put my bag on the floor. There was nowhere else to put it. She turned away. "Tom, your room is next door." They disappeared, but I could hear the mumble of voices through the wall as I took my jacket off and listened to the constant hum of the air conditioning. Her rubber-soled boots soon came squeaking past, and she paused in the doorway. "Would you like some coffee, Nick? And maybe something to eat? Then we must get to work. We don't have much time." "Yeah, thanks." She nodded and made her way back towards the living area. I repositioned my bag in the corner of the room. It seemed out of place anywhere else, as Tom stuck his head round the door.
"Nice one, mate. She worth a few bob or what? You coming for a brew?"
A couple of minutes later, Tom and I sat facing each other on the white leather. The settee made creaking sounds as we got comfortable, and the clink of china came from the kitchen. It seemed I wouldn't get anything out of him while Liv was about, which wasn't a bad thing, really. At least it shut him up. We sat and waited with only the low hum of the heating for company. She reappeared with a full percolator, milk and mugs on a tray, and a plate of crisp breads and sliced cheese. Placing it on the glass table, she sat down next to Tom. I wasn't sure whether he was wriggling with pleasure or embarrassment.
"Let me explain the setup," she said. "I will be staying here with you both. My room is over on the other side."
She pointed to the opposite door.
"The room across from your bedrooms is where the laptop is, for you, Tom, to decrypt the firewall. I'll tell you more about that in a moment."
She turned to me.
"Nick, also in there are maps of the house you'll be visiting."
She started to pour.
"By Tuesday morning, you must have discovered the access sequence, entered the house, and copied the files. If not, my instructions are that the deal is off."
I sat and listened, knowing that even if I had to make a pact with the devil, it would all be completed in time. I wanted this money. I needed this money. Liv and I took a sip of black coffee. Tom didn't touch his, obviously not wanting to be a nuisance and ask for anything herbal. We lapsed back into a strained silence. She sat and watched our discomfort, almost enjoying it. It made me feel as if she knew more about Tom and me than we did about her. At length I said, "It will happen." Tom nodded.
"No drama." "I'm sure it will. We will discuss the minor details of money, information exchange, and so on later."
She stood up.
"Come, bring your drinks. Let's start work."
We followed her down the corridor. The room on the right was just as white as the rest of the house, and very large and rectangular. There were two pine desks and chairs. One had an aluminium briefcase on it, the other a small, black, sleek-looking IBM laptop, a bit smaller than an A4 sheet of paper, together with the box it had come in, with spare leads draped over the top and a thin black nylon carry bag with a shoulder strap. Liv pointed at the briefcase.
"Tom? That ThinkPad is for you. Nick, come."
She continued to the other desk. As she and Tom started to talk firewall stuff, I unclipped the case and lifted the lid. I found several marked maps, all of different scales. it looked as if we were aiming for a town called La Piranta, about 120 km to the east of us and close to the Russian border. The largest-scale map showed that the whole area was a massive system of lakes, maybe more than 100 km square, with hundreds of small islands and inlets dotted with villages and small towns. The target was just over 20 km north of La Piranta, along a road linking some of the islands to an area called Kuhala. The house wasn't lakeside, but set back about a kilometre from the water and surrounded by forest. Liv left us to it, and I watched her go. She was unbelievably cool. I realised that I was beginning to like her a lot. "Hey, Tom." I turned to face him. He was hunched over the small screen, his back to me. He turned in his chair and looked up. "What's the matter, mate?" "I think it would be better if you didn't mention anything to Liv about the money. It's just that she may be getting less than us and we'll get a bit pissed off. If she asks, just say you don't know, okay?"
"Isn't this her place, then?"
"I doubt it. She's just working on the job, like us. I think it would be best if we kept our cards close to our chests, okay?" He turned back to the desk.
"If you say so, mate. Whatever."
The keys started to clink away once more under his dancing fingers.
"Means Jack to me."
I returned to the material spread out in front of me. Maps are useful things, but they only go so far. I needed to get my arse on target and do a proper recce. I listened to Tom minting around behind me as I sat and memorised the maps. The best way I'd learned to do this was by visualising the route I'd take. It was far easier than trying to remember place names and road numbers. I sat there, staring at the blank wall, making my way from Hinala to the target house, when I noticed a piece of plasterboard missing around a 2-pin plug. I got on my knees and had a look, pulling back the edge of the board to reveal lead sheeting behind, covered with a plastic cling-film-type lining. I glanced back at Tom. He was still hammering on the keyboard like a man possessed. I pushed the plasterboard back in place and walked around the room, looking for any more holes. Then I realised there weren't any phone jacks. Even in a modern house, that was taking minimalism a bit far. Was it to make this place impossible to communicate with electronically? If so, Val took his work very seriously indeed, and it unnerved me a bit. I didn't like discovering things that I should know already. I walked across to Tom's desk and stood over him, looking at a screen full of numbers and letters. Some of the vertical lines would change every time he hit a key.
"Do you understand what you've got there?"
"No problem. It's all about algorithms and protocols, hardened proxy, stuff like that. What it boils down to is that I need to find the access sequence among a million or so different sets of characters. That's the firewall between me and the rest of the system."
He pointed at the screen, never letting his eyes wander from it.
"This is quite a sophisticated crypto, as it has a learning program that detects unusual events, like me trying to hack in, and interprets them as an attack. If we were trying to do this on site, I wouldn't be able to do it in time, but this setup is perfect. I have time to play."
His attention was drawn away from talking to me as he leaned forward slightly and studied the screen. We were both silent for a few seconds as he mumbled crypto stuff to himself. Then he came back to planet Earth.
"Anyway, once I've hacked into it here, all I have to do is configure the ThinkPad. Bring it with me, and then I can download all the files she wants. Easy life."
I watched him as he did his stuff. He'd turned into the master of his universe, hands gliding over the keys, quick, confident and in command. Even his tone had changed as he explained what he was up to.
"Tom, will you be able to get past this thing?"
The screen full of moving numbers, letters and symbols looked like total confusion to me.
"No drama, mate, no drama."
I looked over at the broken plasterboard.
"One more question."
His eyes still didn't leave the screen.
"What's that?"
I changed my mind.
"I'm going for a brew. You come in."
"Nah, mate. I'm going to stay here. Things to do, know what I mean?"
I left him to it. I wanted to know why the lead was there, and maybe he could help, but why risk him flapping? The less he knew, the better. Chapter 16. I walked into the living area after having no luck finding a phone point in my bedroom. The lights were still on, but the room was empty, and the coffee things had been cleared away. There was only a thick paperback book on the glass table. I wandered around the room, checking for points, but didn't find any. There were none in the kitchen either. I couldn't see any gaps in the wall covering to check for lead, so I decided to go a different route. Walking over to the ceiling-to-floor blinds, I gave one of them a poke. It didn't move and was extremely hard and heavy. There was a switch on the wall nearby, and you didn't need to be a brain surgeon to work out what it did. When I flicked it, a motor whirred above me in the ceiling. I watched as they began to open from the center. It was dark outside, but the living room lights exposed a long, narrow balcony beyond triple-glazed sliding doors. Virgin snow lay a meter deep all along it, resting against the glass. A little further out, the tops of a few snow-covered pine trees were also visible, but beyond that was inky blackness. I turned, hearing bare feet moving towards me. Liv was 6 or 7 steps away, wearing a blue silk dressing gown which finished just above her knees, exposing each thigh in turn as she moved. 2 more steps, and she reached past me and hit the switch. She smelled as if she'd just stepped out of the shower. The motor whirred and the blinds began to close again. She took a step back.
Nick, the blinds must remain closed at all times when Tom is working on the computer.
She waved a palm in the direction of the settees.
Shall we sit?
As she crossed the room, I followed. She saw my eyes flick to the blinds and guessed what I was about to say.
Yes, Nick, before you ask, they are lined with lead. The whole house is. Valentin doesn't like his competitors learning what he's doing. Millions of dollars are spent accessing information about rivals in this business. He ensures that it's money wasted, as far as spying on him is concerned. Valentin knows the true value of information. Not money, but power.
So that's why no phones. The blinds finished closing as we sat facing each other on the settees. As she tucked her legs underneath her, the silk followed the contours of her body.
Please, Nick, will you tell Tom? House rule.
No problem. But will you do me a favor in return? It would make things a lot easier for us if you didn't tell Tom anything about the Malaskaya, or about the deal we have. He's a warrior and I want him to concentrate on the job. The last thing I needed was her telling him how much money was really involved.
Of course,
she smiled.
I never have a problem with keeping information to a minimum. On the other hand, I also find it better to tell the truth about important matters. Maybe Tom would be better off knowing about the Malaskaya and the money, rather than possibly finding out at a later date. Lies can be so confusing and counterproductive, but then I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that, do you?
I wasn't too sure if it was a rhetorical question. Whatever. I wasn't going to give her a full answer. I shrugged. She leaned forward to pick up the book on the coffee table, and as she settled back, her silk dressing gown fell down on either side of her legs. I tried not to look, but couldn't help myself. Liv was one of the most beautiful, attractive, and intelligent women I'd ever seen. It was a pity I had champagne tastes and a lemonade budget. I would never have what it took to attract somebody like her, and, sadly, she didn't strike me as the sort to dispense charity shags to the poor. She pulled the gown together as she caught my eye.
Does this bother you? You English are so strange. You're so repressed.
What about you lot? I grinned. You seem to be so reserved with strangers, yet think nothing of sitting naked with them in saunas, chatting about the weather. Then you charge out and roll naked in the snow, beating yourselves with birch twigs. So who's running on a full tank? She smiled.
We're all prisoners of our past, and maybe we Finns more than most.
That one got me knitting my brow. It was a bit too deep for me.
I don't expect you to understand this, Nick, but Nordic myth is more deeply ingrained in our psyche than in any of the other Scandinavian cultures. Probably a legacy of all those centuries of Swedish and Russian domination.
She tapped the book.
A collection of Finnish folklore. See? We're captivated.
I'm more of a Harry Potter man myself, I said. I didn't know what the fuck she was talking about. It was her turn to look puzzled. She probably thought he wrote spy thrillers, or whatever crap I read.
Nick, I need to finalize some drop-off, she corrected herself, dead letterbox details with you for the information and money exchange. We shall all go to Helsinki in the morning, even if Tom hasn't got through the firewall by then. It's important that he isn't kept in the dark.
I opened my mouth to speak, but she seemed to have accessed my own firewall. I wasn't sure whether to be flattered or alarmed by the fact that she seemed to know exactly what I was thinking.
Nick, I've already told you there is nothing to be concerned about. No one is looking for you there. Otherwise, it would be pointless going, wouldn't it? We all want you to be successful. So why would we be taking such a risk?
That made sense. But it was less than a week since Carpenter had turned Helsinki into Dodge City, and I didn't want to find myself next door to anyone who mistook me for one of his close personal friends.
Once you and Tom have left tomorrow night, you must never return here, whatever happens. That way this place remains secure. In any event, no one will be here, as I am leaving soon after you. I will take anything you want to leave behind, and return it at the exchange. You are to make your way to the DLB on Wednesday morning, and leave details for a meeting between just the two of us. The details of the exchange are totally your concern. Valentin wants to give you control of the arrangements, as a gesture of good faith, and to give you confidence that nothing uncomfortable will occur during the transaction. To help ensure this, you will still be in contact exclusively with me.
She gave me the full benefit of those wonderful eyes.
Do not worry, Nick. This business is not being conducted in a way that jeopardizes any of us.
I tried not to laugh. Maybe she hadn't noticed how people like Val conducted business. If he didn't have control of an apartment block, he'd blow it up, no matter who was still inside. I wasn't quite ready to assume he was my new best friend. In the meantime, I would pick the time and place, and they would come to me. It made sense. I nodded. What if I don't make the dead letterbox?
If you don't, Tom will. That is why he needs to be with us tomorrow. If there's no message for me by Wednesday evening, I'll know that something is seriously wrong and the deal is off. Sometimes you win. Other times,
she shrugged. There was silence for a moment or two. How did you come to meet Valentin?
Like you. He asked me to work for him.
She smiled, crossing her legs.
And no, Nick, I'm not his mistress.
She'd read my mind again. 300 years ago, she would have been burned at the stake.
The only thing he wants from me is my doctorate in Russian political science. You see, Nick, this is where the money is, for now. And the fact is, I enjoy that money. I work hard, and I'm well rewarded.
She sat back, and when she spoke again, her voice was low.
My parents were Swedish. They are both dead now. I was born here, in Finland. I am a Finn. There. That is all you need to know about me. But what about you, Nick? Why did you become a kidnapper? Did you not work for the British government?
I coughed, trying unsuccessfully to hide my embarrassment. It made sense that she would know. If she knew about the connection between Tom and me, then there was a whole lot more she probably knew too. So much for being a deniable operator. I suddenly wasn't enjoying this as much as I thought I was going to. Money, I said. Just like you. Maybe we're the same. She gave me her most inscrutable Mr. Spock look.
Of course. That is why you are here.
Her face broke into a smile.
Are you married?
Divorced.
What happened, Nick? Did she not like to live with lies and half-truths?
I think she just didn't like living with me. I paused. I used to be in the military and...
Yes. Valentin knows about your military past, Nick. That is one of the reasons you are here.
What else did he know? I didn't like the postman knowing what I looked like, let alone the head of a major organized crime group. It made me feel very uncomfortable. I said, what about you? Are you married?
I'm not so sure it would be a good idea.
And being a mother?
It does not interest me. Do you have children?
No. I've made light of it. I can just about manage to look after myself. It would be such a responsibility. What would I do if they became ill? She gave me a level look.
I think we have both done the right thing, Nick. Don't you?
I tried to read her expression and failed again. I didn't reply for a while, and when I did, I answered one question with another. Are you staying with us all the time, Liv?
I'll come and go. But essentially, I'm here to make sure things run smoothly.
She adjusted herself on the settee. I got another glimpse of thigh as she tapped the book by her side.
There is a story in here about Wainamoinen, the creator of the universe. One day he has an encounter with Jukkahainen, a much younger god. The two meet riding on a narrow path, and neither wants to give way. Jukkahainen challenges Wainamoinen with all the eagerness of youth and limitless self-confidence. The battle is waged by chanting magical songs, and ends with Jukkahainen finding himself in a bog. You see, Nick, he simply didn't know who he was dealing with.
I took the point. Knowing who you're dealing with had always been a big thing with me. And right now the message seemed to be, they did, and I didn't. What time are we leaving in the morning?
8. Will you tell Tom?
She yawned.
Time for bed, I think. Good night, Nick.
I watched her walk towards the door. Night, Liv. She disappeared into the other half of the house. I couldn't help a smile of regret when I realized that her leaning across me to flick a wall switch was the closest we were ever likely to get. Will of the gods and all that. Chapter 17. Monday, 13th of December, 1999. We headed south along the motorway towards Helsinki. All dressed exactly the same as yesterday. Tom had headed straight for the back seat and crashed out, which left me with the option of joining him or sitting next to Liv in the front. I knew what I wanted to do, but I felt I should give her some space. It was nearly 8:45, and after 30 minutes of staring at headlights, it had begun to get light. It was going to be a sunny day. There wasn't a cloud in the sky, and the unfolding view of pine trees and glittering snow was straight out of a ski brochure. I looked across at Tom, earpieces in and eyes closed. The scenery was lost on him. He was fast asleep, his head bouncing gently in time with the 4x4's movement. He'd been up late at his screen. I'd got him to bring all his documents, even on this shopping trip. I told him it was just in case we needed to leave in a hurry. Be prepared, Tom. Know what I mean? He hadn't been too keen on coming, because after working much of the night, he was close to breaking the firewall. but I agreed with Liv. He needed to be aware of the game plan. We were both acting for our own selfish reasons. If there was a problem on target, then Tom was the only one to get away. She had to know there was still a chance she could get the data to Val. And I wanted him along because if I broke a leg or wasn't able to make the DLB to collect my money for any other reason, I wanted Tom to be able to do it for me. Another 40 minutes and we hit Helsinki city limits. Liv gave me a guided tour as we came in, pointing out some landmarks and proudly telling about how her tiny nation had routed the Red Army in the 1940 Winter War. All the while, Tom's head bounced about beside me. It was quite strange seeing the place during the day. I'd never come in until last light during the recce for Bald's lift. There was no reason to expose myself and the team to CCTV, and the security set up for the EU conference. No matter what the environment, it's always better to recce in the dark. And in this place, there was plenty of it. The city looked older than I'd been expecting. The airport and Intercontinental were both modern buildings, and Tom's ranting about how cutting-edge the place was had led me to expect a city full of buildings like Vauxhall Cross. As we weaved towards the centre, the heavy morning traffic jockeyed with the trams to gain ground, but was generally well-behaved.
"I think it's time for Tom to pay attention now, Nick."
I gave him a shake.
"What? What?"
His eyes opened, and he stretched as if he was coming out of hibernation. I pointed at my mouth, indicating to him that he'd do well to wipe the dribble from his chin.
"Cheers, mate."
He looked outside at the traffic.
"This Helsinki, then? Looks just like the virtual tour."
Liv smiled.
"I think you will find the real thing a bit chillier."
We turned a corner, passing a large illuminated sign telling us that this department store was called Stockman. She pointed at the large window displays as we drove past.
"We'll meet in the coffee shop on the 6th floor. The station is just a couple of minutes' walk away."
We drove on a couple of blocks before stopping. As I got out, I felt the bitter cold for the first time that day. With the garage being a sealed, air-conditioned part of the house, the open air hadn't had a chance to get at us. She looked back at me through the rear doors as I put my hat and gloves on.
"I'll see you both in Stockman in 2 hours. You'll need about half an hour to check out the station."
I nodded and turned to Tom. "We'll use the rest of the time to get our kit." I closed the door of the 4x4 and she drove off. Our breath hung in clouds in front of our faces, and every inch of exposed skin prickled with the cold. Tom didn't like it one bit.
"Arctic or what, Nick? For fuck's sake, can we get inside sharpish?"
The station was in front of us. It looked like an East German prison, very square and imposing, faced with what looked like dirty brown concrete. It could have been used as a backdrop for 1984. I checked the clock tower with Baby G, and they agreed to the minute. 10:22. As we joined the rest of the pedestrian traffic, waiting obediently for the little green man, Tom frowned and said,
"Nick?"
"What?" I was concentrating more on looking for a gap between the trams that I could dash through. I had no intention of freezing to death waiting for little green men.
"Do you trust her? You know, Liv. You sure everything's sweet?"
Liv's advice about being truthful flashed through my head, thankfully not powerfully enough for me to take it. I tried never to trust anyone, and after what had happened in Washington, I certainly wasn't going to now. There might not be too much time to do this job correctly, and I might be desperate for the cash. But I wouldn't be doing anything until I'd put my own and Tom's safety net in place today. The lights changed, and we started walking. "Don't worry, mate. Everything is fine. In fact, having a meeting point like this is one of the things that makes me feel better about her. It means these people are switched on, and want the job done with no hassle. Don't worry about it." He shrugged.
"Yeah? But what can you do to guarantee we aren't getting stitched up like a kipper, know what I mean? Are you going to do what she wants? You know, come back here and give her the ThinkPad with the download and take the money. Or are you going to ask for more? I bet it's worth a bomb."
even if the thought had crossed my mind, I wasn't going to admit it to him.
No, mate. I just want to do this right. Just exchange that little machine of yours for the money and get back to the UK. That way everything stays safe and easy. Whichever way you look at it, it's still good money. All the time, I had my smiley face on. I felt like I was trying to encourage a small child to eat his sprouts. I was expecting more questions, but he just shrugged his shoulders again.
I only ask him, mate. If it's good enough for you, it's good enough for me.
Tell you what, she's toasty, isn't she?
I grinned. Yes, she's very beautiful. Out of our league, though, son. I somehow couldn't picture Liv kissing Juicy Lucy cards in Notting Hill, or spending her day sorting out my boiler. The main doors to the station were heavy and wooden, with porthole windows protected by metal grills. We pushed through and immediately came face to face with Santa, who was ringing his bell and demanding money. We sidestepped him. The interior looked more like a well-kept museum than a railway station, with clean, stone-paved floors, thick granite-supporting pillars and unbelievably high ceilings. Little snowmen hung from chandeliers, and the place echoed with public announcements, people talking, mobile phones going off all over the place and, in one corner, a busker who was having a crack at the Finnish version of Good King Wenceslas on his accordion. The smell of cigarette smoke and fast food was strong and everywhere. A group of people with Santa hats on and sets of skis over their shoulders tried to squeeze past stressed-out businessmen in overcoats, furry Cossack hats, and mobiles glued to their ears. The strange thing was that you couldn't see or hear a single train. This was a cold-weather station, and the platforms were outside. Tom rubbed his hands together. He liked it in here.
Christ, I almost feel human again. What now then, Nick?
Father Christmas carried on doing his stuff as we stood and got our bearings, and I thought almost was as close as Tom was ever going to get. Liv's DLB was very easy to find and, like the one at the Langham, sighted well. We were standing with our backs to the main entrance. In front of us was a wide stairway and escalators that led down into the metro. The three sides of the stairway surrounded an open square of continuous wooden benches. The DLB was by a rubbish bin on the left-hand side. Tom followed as I walked between the DLB and the large ticketing hall to our left, heading for a newsstand. A teenaged girl was sitting reading a magazine, ears full of Walkman, mouth full of gum. She was wearing navy blue duvet salopettes under a matching jacket which was open to stop her sweating. I nodded at Tom just before we got level with her.
There it is, mate. See the girl in blue?
He nodded back and we carried on past. Okay. If you put your hand underneath the bench, exactly where she's sitting, you're going to feel a plastic container attached by Velcro. All you do is make sure no one's looking and pull it off. Go away and write a note telling them where they can find you and they'll come.
Isn't this all a bit James Bond, Nick? I don't like it.
It's just belt and braces stuff. You need to know what to do if it goes wrong. You know, suppose I break a leg and can't get back here. Then it'll be down to you to hand over the goods and get us our money.
So long as there ain't no funny business. You know, fucking her about or anything. I don't want that, mate. I just want the money.
We stopped by the wall next to the newsstand. Tom, it's going to go like clockwork. You just need to know this stuff in case I get injured. That's all. You're my insurance policy and I'll be yours. He liked that. The girl got up and walked towards us, nodding her head in time to the music stuck in her ears.
Go on. See if there's anything there yet. What, now?
He looked absolutely terrified.
Well, everyone's here.
It's never going to be empty, Tom. It's a station, for fuck's sake. All you've got to do is take a stroll over there, sit down, put your hand under the bench and have a feel around. While you're doing that, I'll go and change the money for you, all right?
I didn't wait for his answer. I wanted him to go through the motions. If he had to get here on his own, he'd at least know what to do. I walked further into the station. Signs in front of me pointed to the platforms and the long-term left luggage. I'd be checking that out soon enough. As busy-looking people passed through the large wooden doors, I saw snow-covered carriages standing at each platform. To my right were shops and toilets, and, about 50 meters away, the exit to the bus station. To the left were more shops and the short-term left luggage lockers, then another set of doors the same distance away that led out to the taxi rank. Behind me were the metro stairs and a very nervous Tom. I went left, to the Bureau de Change, exchanged $500, then wandered back. As I neared the DLB, I could see him sitting on the bench, looking very pleased with himself. I sat next to him, squeezing into the small gap between him and a rather large woman peeling an orange.
"Piece of piss, mate. Found it first time, look."
He started to bend down.
"No, no, not now, Tom. Leave it where it is, and I'll show you how to tell Liv that you've put a message in there for her."
I stood up and he followed. The woman was delighted and spread herself out more. We went towards the platform doors and turned right, passing the toilets. "Tom, go in there to write your message, okay?" He nodded, his eyes fixed on the English edition computer magazines as we passed another newsstand, with yet more people wrestling with their luggage and skis. I explained where to leave his DLB-loaded marker. "Just beyond this coffee shop, on the right, is a row of telephones. When the time comes, get yourself a marker pen from one of these shops and draw a line down the booth of the right-hand one, okay?" It wasn't.
"Why?"
"So Liv doesn't have to sit down and feel under the bench every time to check it. If the loaded sign, the marker pen line, isn't there, she knows that a message isn't either. Otherwise, she'll look just a bit suspicious on Wednesday, won't she? Sitting in the same place every hour on the hour." He nodded thoughtfully.
"Tell you what, she could sit next to me every hour on the hour, know what I mean?"
I smiled. If the two women at the airport would have had him for breakfast, Liv would probably chew him up and spit him out without looking up from her newspaper. We were closing the gap towards the bus station doors when they all opened at once, and a coachload of people surged towards us, dragging their skis and luggage behind them. 10 meters short of the doors was a bank of 4 phones fixed to the wall, divided by polished wood booths. We stood against the nearest one, letting the coach party pass with a rumble of suitcase wheels and excited conversation.
"See here," I said.
"Yeah. You want me to mark..."
He started to wave his finger.
"Hey, Tom. In Spyland, nobody points."
I pushed his hand down and tried not to laugh.
"But yes, that's right, mate. A mark. But a line, a nice, thick line. Make sure you pretend to be on the phone and make sure they..." I nodded towards the flower shop opposite. "Don't see you."
Tom's eyes followed mine.
"I'll get it. But you'll tell me what to say in the letter, yeah?"
"Of course. Now let's go and get cold." We walked out through the bus station, a large square concourse littered with sheltered stops. Once onto the pavement, we cut half right in the direction of Stockman. I handed Tom 2,000 Finnish marks from the wad I'd got from the money changer. It worked out at about 6 marks a dollar. He thought he was rich. His eyes shone. Or maybe they were starting to be affected by the cold as we walked along cobbled stone streets. The rumble of tyres and metallic rhythm of the tram wheels meant we had to speak louder than normal.
"Tom, I want you to give me your passport and wallet for safekeeping. I've got an idea for a little extra insurance, but listen, this is between you and me. It's not that I don't trust her, but better safe than sorry, eh?"
"Nice one, Nick. Makes me feel better."
He handed them over without questioning. It made me feel suddenly more responsible for him.
"Besides, we want to travel light tomorrow night."
You could tell Stockman was Finland's top people's store by the line of large black or dark blue cars outside with their engines running, waiting for their VIP passengers to come out and load up their Christmas shopping. When we got closer, it was clear who the cars belonged to. Large men with no necks and square heads were waiting beside them. It looked as though Mr. and Mrs. Mafia were flapping a bit because of the hit on Val last week. A group of heavies came out just as we approached the main entrance, surrounding a very young, beautiful blonde who was wearing more fur than a grizzly. For a moment I thought it was Liv. A limo door opened for her, and the three-car convoy zoomed off up the street. Tom and I walked through large double doors straight into the perfume department. A little further on, in the luggage department, I picked up two small weekend bags, one dark green and one black, from a display, and two heavy car blankets. Tom had his big wad of money clasped firmly in his hand and was looking happy. It was time to say my goodbyes. "I've got things to do, Tom. Insurance." I tapped the side of my nose and winked. His big hamster cheeks beamed back. "I'll see you in the coffee shop in about 3/4 of an hour. Just get yourself some good warm kit. The sort of stuff I told you about, all right?"
"Yeah, yeah. No drama. Hey, Nick, when the going gets tough, the tough go shopping."
He rubbed his thumb and forefinger together. I clapped his shoulder. "Remember, get a decent coat and boots. And by the way, if Liv turns up before I get there, just tell her I'm shopping too." I could see he couldn't be asked to ask why. He just wanted to get spending.
"No drama. See ya."
Back in the cold, I took out my new holdalls and bulked them out with the blankets. Then I headed for the bus station again. I went past the telephones into Europe's most expensive toilets. It cost me nearly £1 to sit down in one of the cubicles so I could get out the money from my organizer wallet. What was left of the $25,000 in $100 bills, which I'd brought with me. I removed $4,000 and then placed the wallet, plus my own documents and Davidson's, into the dark green holdall. You never know when even a burned ID can come in useful. Tom's documents and $3,000 went into the black bag, and I slipped the remaining grand into my pocket. I then dumped both that left luggage and looked for a decent hiding place for the two tickets, our own little DLB. Somewhere that Tom would find easy enough to remember. I went into one of the shops and picked up a computer magazine with a plastic sleeve holding a free CD-ROM. I was queuing at the checkout when I saw her. Liv was standing by the doors to the trains. The man she was with was very smartly dressed in a long camel hair coat, shirt and tie. She was looking quite dolled up herself, in a black overcoat she hadn't been wearing earlier. It must have been in the back of the Merc 4x4. I ducked out of the queue as if I'd had second thoughts about the magazine and went back to browsing the racks, watching Liv and her man out of the corner of my eye. They were in each other's arms, their faces just inches apart and talking away. They were doing their best to look like two lovers saying their goodbyes, but it wasn't quite working. There were times when they cuddled, but they weren't talking to each other, they were talking at each other. I'd done this enough times myself to know what was going on. They held each other and talked for a little while longer, then he pulled slightly away from her. He was in his early 30s with short, brown hair and looked quite the young, trendy businessman. She turned away, heading for the bus station exit. There had been no final kiss, no last touch or stroke of the hair. I let her go past me, then moved quickly to the platform doors, pinging him on platform 6 as he looked at his ticket and checked the coaches. It was now time to hurry back the other way and see what Liv was up to. Barging through the bus station doors, I looked out onto the square. She was walking away from me, putting her Tibetan hat on, heading across the pedestrian crossing. I could see the 4x4 on the other side, parked in a line of other vehicles on meters. Turning, I ran back into the station. The destination board said the Platform 6 train was leaving for St. Petersburg in 2 minutes. I walked swiftly back to the newsstand and bought the magazine, together with a reel of sellotape. Taking off the plastic sleeve, I ripped it into 2 strips and wrapped the tickets individually. Now all I had to do was find a place to hide them that Tom would remember. It wasn't hard. The long banks of left luggage lockers by the taxi exit were on legs, with a 4-inch gap between them and the floor. Pretending to clean the slush off my shoes, I taped Tom's under number 10 and mine under number 11. If things went wrong, Both of us had a ticket out of Finland. As I made my way back to Stockman, Liv's meeting with the man in the camel hair coat mulled round in my head. I took the lift to the sixth floor. Once I'd passed the cold weather gear, a sign told me that on the floor above was cold storage for furs. I passed a restaurant, a juice bar, and found Tom in Café Avec, overlooking the shoppers below on the fifth floor. His half cup of herbal whatever looked sad and cold on the table in front of him. The lightwood furniture had come straight out of an IKEA warehouse, and the place was packed with people snacking on soup or little fish dishes. The noise was deafening. People talking and mobiles going off with a million and one different tunes. "Whatcha, mate?" He was all smiles, pointing at his bags, then opening one for me to look inside. I was pleased to see he'd bought himself a decent pair of boots, and the dark blue, thick woolen check lumberjack coat was just the sort of thing I'd told him to get. "Great, Tom. Now listen." I explained to him where his ticket was hidden. We'd pick them up on Wednesday, but if the shit hit the fan tomorrow night, he should head straight for the station, grab his bag, and catch the first flight home. He started to look a bit more cheerful. "I just want to get this job done and get back to London with some dosh. I don't really like it here. Thought I would, but I don't. Must be the cold. That's why I got these for tomorrow." He bent down and brought out a set of silk leggings and a top. I tried not to laugh. They were the sort of thing you might buy for your very first ski trip, but never wear. He looked rather proud of them. "What do you think? Keep me warm or what? You should get some, Nick. The girl behind the counter said they're great." "I bet she did. They probably cost three times as much as a set of proper thermals." "I've got some," I lied. "Actually, there's one more thing." He packed them proudly back into the bag.
"What's that?"
"I know you said you're nearly there, but can you really break through the firewall by tomorrow?" He looked at me as if I was mad.
"No problem. But you will look after me, won't you? You know, when we're in there."
I could sense that his bravado was fading slightly as the witching hour approached. I smiled, nodded, and then saw him look anxiously over my shoulder.
"Liv's here."
I turned in my seat and watched her looking out for us both, hat in hand and the black coat still on. She saw my raised hand and came straight over. She sat down.
"Everything all right at the station?"
I nodded.
"Good. Here are the keys for your car, Nick."
She passed over two keys on a Saab key fob.
"There are maps inside the glove box to get you there, and a detailed one of the area. None of the maps are marked. It will take you more than 3 hours to get there."
"There'll probably be a list of things I'll need once I've seen the house."
"No problem. So long as it's nothing exotic."
Talking of which, she looked at her Cartier watch. I got the hint and started getting to my feet. "I think I need to get going. I want to spend as much time as I can on target." She stood up.
"I'll show you where the car is, then go back to the house with Tom."
As we came out of Stockman, Tom took out his new check coat and put it over the one he was wearing. He looked the perfect tourist. We walked back towards the station, and I could see the Merc 4x4 still parked in the same position, with a shiny new blue Saab next to it. I said my goodbyes. Tom got in the front with her, and they drove off. Chapter 18. The journey to the target seemed to be taking longer than she'd told me to expect. Maybe it just felt that way, because there'd been nothing to look at but thousands of trees and lumps of granite. I needed to adjust my boredom threshold. It was just after 3 o'clock, and it was already last light. The reflection from the Saab's headlights twinkled in the snow piled high at the roadside as I stayed obediently in the line of traffic, which all travelled within the speed limit. I hit the seat button on the radio a few times, but there wasn't much to listen to. I hated Europop, and didn't have a clue what was being said on any of the speaking stations. I used the time to think about Liv's station RV, but didn't come up with any answers. I decided I just had to get on with it. It was simple. I'd do the job, control the exchange with Liv, then get Tom and me back to the UK, leaving Val to do whatever he wanted with the stuff. At least after tomorrow night, once on the ground, I was in control of my own destiny. After taking the exit for Lapinranta, signs for Kuhala began to appear. Pulling into the side of the road, I checked the smaller scale, more detailed map. I had another 12 k's to go until turning off the two-lane road and onto what looked like a minor gravel one. Then, I'd need to find the private turning to the target building. I pushed on, driving through dense forest on a tarmac firebreak. Tall trees on either side of me cut down the headlight's capacity as if I was in a tunnel. Then I was suddenly out of it, and rumbling across a wooden bridge, my lights blazing across the white ice of the frozen lake beneath me. 20 seconds later, I was back inside the tunnel, with just the occasional postbox to let me know I wasn't the only person around. Passing a yellow triangle sign showing a silhouetted elk, I knew I'd well and truly hit the countryside. Stopping at the crossroads, I checked the odometer and map. 8 more k's, and the third option right. I drove on, counting off the k's, crossing 2 more bridges and only a handful of postboxes, until I found the junction I was looking for. The tyre noise changed as I hit the 2-lane gravel road. Like the one leading to Liv's, it was still iced over, but had been snow-ploughed and gritted. With a few k's still to go, I wanted to make sure I had the right track to target first time. It wouldn't be a good idea to mince around with headlights on and the engine revving up and down the road. The map showed a scattering of houses in the area, and I was passing a postbox every 0.5 kilometer or so. I changed down to first gear. There wasn't a light to be seen as I checked off each track into the woods on the map. I found the target track, but kept going, looking for somewhere off the road to lead the Saab, so it looked parked rather than abandoned. About another 300 meters on, I found a small cut in the woodline which seemed to be a firebreak. Once tucked in, I switched off the engine. It was free.